You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
This is Gary Powers Jr. I'd highly recommend that you listen to Cold War Conversations.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com.
Welcome to the Cold War Conversations 2018 roundup, and thank you to all our listeners and guests who've stuck with us and made the podcast what it is. If you're new or old to the podcast, I hope this episode will make you dip into episodes you might have missed or you thought were not your cup of tea. I'd like to especially thank those listeners who have left such positive reviews on iTunes and have contributed financially via Patreon or as one-off donations. If you haven't left a review yet, just head over to coldwarconversations.com and click on the Support the Podcast menu option. If you'd like to support us with a few quid, dollars or rubles, click on the Support the Podcast menu option as well at coldwarconversations.com. It's been quite a year for me. I started this project in March 2018 and had no idea where it would go. I have been astounded by the response and range of guests we've had on, and I've been privileged to speak to the son of a former Soviet premier. I've sat chatting over coffee in the kitchen of a former East German army officer in Liverpool and boarded a Soviet submarine in Kent. Now that would make quite a bucket list on its own. Anyway, you don't want to listen to my ramblings. Here's a whistle-stop tour of Cold War Conversations 2018. Enjoy. The first episode we started with proper was with Michael K. Ferris, who told us about his life in Berlin as the child of Air Force personnel and how he subsequently joined the US Air Force himself and worked in signals intelligence in the 1980s. Not the best sound quality I've ever had on the show, but I've learnt a lot since then. Here is an excerpt from that interview.
In 1960, he was assigned to West Berlin, to the 612 security school. My mother and I were supposed to follow up quickly to join him, but I think what happened was because of the political tension over the U-2 crisis, they froze all military dependents from coming overseas. So my mother and I ended up being stuck in Pittsburgh for a year. And then once President Kennedy became president, he eventually lifted the freeze. And my mother and I showed up in West Berlin on August 10th, 1961. So I could say that I lived in Berlin for three entire days. And then, of course, what happened August 13th, everybody knows, the wall went up.
Our next episode was with Craig McCracken, where we talked about the strange world of East German football, with matches being rigged and that unforgettable result where East Germany beat West Germany in 1974.
And infamously, he is said to have walked into the dressing room at the end of the game where the Leipzig players were celebrating and said to them, enjoy the celebration because this is the last title you'll ever win. And it was the last title they'd ever win. And there's certainly clear evidence of referee corruption.
Our next episode features my good friend Shane Whaley. And we talk about Berlin, espionage and the GDR. And anybody interested in the GDR, highly recommend Shane and Anchor's GDR radio podcast, which was launched recently. But anyway, have a listen to me and Shane rambling on about the GDR.
Fascinating stories. And it does beg the question of, you know, did they find them all? Or are there others out there that are
there have to be
just gone to ground and are happily
mowing their lawns in Munster or Stuttgart.
Yeah, no, that has to be.
Your interest in East, because you've got a particular interest in East Germany. What started that?
It's a curious story. So back in the 80s, I was a bit of a nerd as a kid, and I used to collect stamps. And you used to send away a pound note. Remember those? And a pound note, a lot of money then. Once a month, you send it off to this address, and you just get back a mixed bag of stamps from all around the world. And for some reason, this guy kept sending me most of the stamps I got was certainly Eastern Europe, and the majority of them were from the GDR. So I had this collection, and I thought, oh, I'm going to specialize in the GDR stamps. And I would go down to Swansea Library, where I grew up, because this was pre-Google, can you believe? And, you know, try and read up on Dresden or Leipzig or Karl Marxstadt, all the places that were mentioned on a stamp, or if a person was mentioned on a stamp. And that was my way of, you know, enjoying the hobby and learning some history.
In episode 6, I spoke with Dr. Richard Millington of Chester University about the little-known 1953 uprising in East Germany. It was a fascinating chat.
You've got RIA spreading the word. You've also got people who commute to East Berlin to work and then go home in the evening. You've got day trippers to East Berlin going there for a break and going home in the evening. Everybody's spreading the word about what they had seen in East Berlin. And then you've got RIAS covering more or less the whole of East Germany. I know Dresden couldn't receive it that well, but so you've got word spreading like that. So it really is not just an East Berlin uprising. It really was an East Germany uprising.
Our next episode was an interview with David Young, author of a trilogy of East German crime books based around the female detective Karin Müller. The real life crime that is sort of like the centerpiece of Stasi Wolf, I found fascinating when I read the book. In fact, when I read the book, I hadn't realized it was a real crime.
I've taken part of it. So that's, the crossword puzzle murder was very specifically a boy of I think age 7 or 8 went missing on the way to the cinema in the early 1980s. His body was found dumped by a railway line about a week later in a suitcase. And the reason it got its name, the crossword puzzle murder, was that the best bit of evidence was this partially completed crossword that in a newspaper that was dumped along with the body. And the handwriting was fairly unusual and typical of an older woman. That's what the handwriting experts thought. And so in real life, they set up what was and still is the biggest ever handwriting sampling exercise in the world. And they collected, with the help of the Stasi, which was what was interesting, they collected more than 500,000 samples of handwriting and did eventually crack the case.
I then talked with Russell Phillips about Warsaw Pact armoured fighting vehicles, which sounds like a dry subject, but we had some fascinating conversations within our interview.
This may be something of a tangent, but...
We like tangents here, Russell, so go for it.
See, something that people don't necessarily think about is that the Soviet Union, of course, wasn't just, we have a tendency to refer to it as Russia sometimes, but it wasn't just Russia. You know, there was all these other states making up the Soviet Union. So even within the Soviet army, you had a massive languages. And that caused real problems for communication within units, because the Soviets didn't like make a Kyrgyz unit and a Georgian unit. They just mashed them all together. Oh. And a lot of the privates, you know, come from Kyrgyzstan or wherever, wouldn't speak Russian.
In our next episode, we moved to Czechoslovakia, where we spoke with journalist Mark Baker about his experiences in Czechoslovakia in the 1980s.
And it never varied how it would happen. We would be chugging along. The train was practically empty. And there would be a sultry-looking woman walking up and down the corridor, looking obviously for an empty compartment, course, all the compartments were basically empty. She would stop at my compartment, sort of knock on the door, pull open the compartment door, and ask in very basic Czech if that seat was free. Of course, you know, I'm looking forward to a nice companion on the train. Why not? Of course it's free. Sit down. And then she would sort of take the seat directly opposite me, never any other seat in the compartment. We would lock eyes. She would flutter her eyebrows. And then at that point, she would say, I hear something funny in your accent. Are you not Czech, or are you English speaker by any chance?
And when you say sultry, Mark, I think you're probably saying quite good looking then.
In episode 10, we went back to 1960s Soviet Union with a road trip with Jeremy Poynton, who was a 16-year-old boy in 1968.
And did you have much interaction with the locals? Did they want to talk to you?
Insofar as most of us pupils only spoke very basic Russian, what we could. I will say that almost wherever we went, if you had to queue for anything, we were always ushered to the front of the queue, which is very kind. And I do remember in Moscow, myself and a friend of mine, we went and had a couple of hours at the zoo and got on a bus, and they wouldn't let us pay.
Wow.
And they realized that we were foreign. Yeah. So
yeah.
It was, one didn't feel I'm amongst the enemy, shall we say.
In episode 11, we return to the UK to talk with Alastair McCann, who has preserved a Royal Observer Corps nuclear monitoring post as a museum in Northern Ireland. Here's an excerpt from our chat.
When they got that phone call to say a bomb is on its way, or, you know, Russia has started massing troops on the border, would they have been able to pick up their bag from the front door, say goodbye to their wife and their kids, walk out that front door and drive to the post, and not for one second think that's probably the last time I'll ever see them?
We then had a fascinating chat with music producer Mark Reeder about his time in Eastern Europe and setting up the first punk concert in East Berlin.
Famous like avant-garde composer in Czechoslovakia, and he was a jazz 77 signature, and he got banned from playing, and his son helped Jakub Topol make Revolver Review, this kind of dissident periodical that they release once a month, and these were the guys who had this gig, and I went there with my friend Ellis to, we went and played our gig there in Czechoslovakia. Not knowing, we thought this kind of thing happened all the time, knowing idea that no one had ever done this before, And I didn't know this until after I'd done the Total Nosen concert, that this was actually the fact. After we'd done the Total Nosen concert in East Berlin, then it kind of manifested itself, that this was the first time that anyone ever dared to do such a thing.
In episode 13, we spoke with Michael Rafferty, who was one of the last US soldiers looking after Checkpoint Charlie at the fall of the wall. It's a fascinating story of 1980s Berlin.
When and where did you hear about the fact that the wall was open?
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNADS.com.
Well, I was watching AFN, so I was just sitting there watching TV when they said that the travel restrictions were being lifted. So I didn't really think anything of it. I called down to the checkpoint, Nate Brown, Staff Sergeant Brown, who is the senior NCOIC down there. Mm-hmm. I said, Nate, is there anything going on? He said, nope, it's pretty boring. And I said, okay, well, I'll be there to relieve you at 6 a.m. He said, okay, I'll see you then. Now, it was Veterans Day. So we were expecting a whole ton of veterans to come up. There was a four-day weekend. So not just veterans, but soldiers coming up because they had a four-day weekend. So we were expecting it to be busy anyways. When I got there at 6 a.m, I was briefed on the way down there that it was a mess. And I got to Nate, and I said, you told me nothing was going on. He just shrugged his shoulders and looked at me like I was crazy. He didn't even say anything to me. He said, it's all yours.
We then returned to Czechoslovakia and one of the most iconic moments of the Cold War, the Prague Spring of 1968. We spoke with Lani Salinger of Socialism Realized about this key event of the Cold War.
But also importantly, the Soviets really liked and trusted Dubček, and they really believed that he was going to be like their man in Czechoslovakia because he had actually completed a significant part of his education in the Soviet Union. So they were really pleased with all of the support that Dubček was getting. And so Brezhnev just stepped out of the way and let the vote happen. And then Dubček became the first secretary in January of 1968. He didn't necessarily see his reforms as like letting go of control, even letting go of like the Communist Party's control.
In episode 15, we returned to East Germany, where we spoke to Sabina, who was 13 when the wall opened.
When was the first time you went over to West Berlin with you? It sounds like your parents are very wary of doing anything during that period.
I think it was the end of November,
right,
1989. And I think partly it was also practicality, because they sort of said, well, if we're going over there now, it's going to be absolutely heaving. We'll just wait until it's calmed down a little bit.
Just avoid the crowds. That sounds like very practical advice.
Yeah.
And what were your first impressions of West Berlin?
We got up quite early and crossed, went over the crossing at Warschauer Straße, where that big bridge is.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And
so I think we went into Kreuzberg, which is probably not the most impressive.
Kind of considered a more, I'd reckon at the time, a more sort of slummy area.
Yeah.
Not slum, like as in, you know.
No,
very working class, very fairly poor.
Yeah, not as glitzy as the Kudamm or somewhere like that.
And I think the first impression I had was how dirty it was, like how much disposable stuff like Coke cans and all kinds of rubbish was strewn around in the street that just we didn't have.
In episode 16, we spoke with Mark Valley, the host of the Live Drop Espionage podcast. Mark served with the US Army as a combat engineer in West Germany and later with the Berlin Brigade. He provided a great eyewitness account of service in both locations.
What were your first impressions of Berlin?
Yeah, it was amazing. I've heard you talk on your show that, you know, it's surprising people say, oh, Berlin, you just picture this dark city with people wearing trench coats and, you know, you think everything's black and white, like a Le Carre novel. But what really threw me when I first got there was just the trees. I mean, these huge, leafy, deciduous trees everywhere, and the parks. And you know, the streets were wide, but they weren't like Hitler wide. They were just, you know, busy. This was a big, thriving city.
In episode 17, we returned to Czechoslovakia to speak to Jan Kulich, who was a 15-year-old at the time of the Prague Spring and went to the same school as Czech communist leader Alexander Dubček's son.
I was very extrovert, and basically this lecturer came and said, you were supposed to sign this, and I just kind of yelled in that class, I'm not going to fucking hell sign this rubbish. And she kind of looked at me and then called me into her cabinet later and said, Jan, you should really sign it. But I didn't. But the secret police called me for an interrogation in connection with this Charter 77 thing.
In episode 18, we returned back to the UK to talk about RAF Greenham Common, the iconic British nuclear base. We spoke with Jonathan Sayers, who is the director of Greenham Control Tower Limited, which is a preserved building on the site of the airbase. Our excerpt talks about the peace protests that were taking place outside the base in the 1980s.
The CND, of course, was formed in 1958, really. I think that it was really, I think the threat, the fear of a war and attack by the Soviet Union was growing, really, from the late 1970s. into 1980, I suppose, was when it really began to kick off. It was in June of 1980 that the Ministry of Defence announced that the cruise missiles would be coming to Green and Manarif Molesworth. And I think, you know, a number of things at that time were happening as well nationally. I mean, the Protect and Survive booklets were issued in 1980. And it was within that kind of psychodrama, I suppose, that the some people felt the threat of nuclear war. You know, the Soviets were about to attack. That kind of mentality and fear was gripping the nation, not just Britain, but similar things were happening in West Germany.
In episode 19, we spoke with Francesca Akhtar about the Able Archer exercise and the nuclear war scare of 1983. This is one of the most popular episodes that we have on the podcast. This excerpt talks about Ronald Reagan's reaction to the news that the Soviet Union really believed a nuclear attack was imminent.
I think it definitely brought home to him the danger of you know, nuclear war. But I think if you sort of read some of the memoirs or what people said, former members of his administration, they sort of say Reagan was kind of going that way anyway. Perhaps the Able Archer thing brought it home and sped up the process more quickly. But it definitely had a very serious impact on him. And if you read in his diary, he sort of, although he doesn't, I believe he doesn't ever mention Able Archer by name, and that could be due to reasons of secrecy and security. But I believe that was what he was referring to. He says that, you know, did the Russians really think that we were planning to attack them, because that wasn't our intention? And he does seem genuinely shocked.
Episode 20 saw us return to East Germany to speak with Anke Holst, the co-host of the GDR Radio podcast. We spoke about her life as an East German teenager in Rostock in the 1980s.
Was giving no warmth at all, and I run around all of New Year's Eve with it because it just looked cool, and there was just no warmth.
So that's
all.
What you do when you're a teenager,
exactly. No. So I was kind of trying to be cool. I think by the time I was 15, I was definitely trying to fit in and be cool.
So. Yeah. And so, were you told not to say anything to anybody else outside the family circle about the relatives in the West?
Yeah, definitely. Well, with us, it was more like being told not to do things rather than being told not to say things.
Our next episode was with Nigel Dunkley, MBE, and it was a real mixture of conversations. We spoke about BRICSMIS, a intelligence organisation that worked through the Cold War in East Germany, gathering intelligence on Soviet and Warsaw Pact troops. We also spoke about Nigel's time as the interpreter for Rudolf Hess, who was Hitler's deputy. Nigel is a former Royal Scots Dragoon Guard, and he served in Berlin with a squadron of Chieftain tanks tasked with defending the British sector. This excerpt is part of that conversation.
You're right. It was actually pretty open. But funnily enough, we anticipated, or somebody had figured out, that one of the main places that they could come through would be to go straight through the Brandenburg Gate, where the wall, of course, was a lot less threatening looking. Mm-hmm. I mean, 3.45 meters high, only 11 and a half feet high anyway, but it was reduced in height and in solidity and offensive depth down at the Brandenburg Gate. So that is... conceivably one of the places where they might have actually come through.
Yeah.
Because it wouldn't have been the Russians coming through, it would have been the East German NVA, the National People's Army, they would have been coming through.
Yeah.
So we dashed straight down and literally just did a gunfight at the OK Corral, face down look, you know, we tried to look mean.
Yeah.
Get the tanks down there without breaking down, which is some, not a mean feat in achievement. And go like, "Hurr, we're here. And we're ready."
Yeah.
Should there be a problem?
Episode 22 saw me take my first ride in a Trabant. I spoke with Alex Goff and Mark Malarkey of the UK-based Wartburg Trabant IFA Club.
And there's a choke down here, so I'm going to sort of ease the choke out a little bit and see if we can crank it going. foremost on the first play.
One thing you find is that no two Trabants will ever sound the same. Like mine is very, very, very heavy with the typical two-stroke ning 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 noise. But then, like Alex's, is more of a purr than it is that traditional two-stroke noise. But you'll never find one that sounds the same.
They all sing differently.
Yeah, even if you've got two brand new engines, two new exhaust systems, they would sound completely and utterly different. It's a very, very unique thing with the Trabants. You think they'd be similar, but no.
Yeah. Right, we're off. We're moving now. Just negotiating a speed hump as we come out the car park here at a massive 10 miles an hour. Episode 23 saw us start our partnership with the Cold War Museum in the United States. We spoke with Gary Powers Jr., who recounted the story of his father and the 1960 U2 incident, where Gary Powers' plane was shot down as it flew over Soviet airspace. Gary Powers was captured and convicted of espionage, and the story was immortalized in the recent Steven Spielberg film Bridge of Spies.
You might as well tell us everything. We'll get it out of your American press anyways. So all of a sudden, for the next 90 days of interrogations, my dad does the following. He tells the full truth when he knows they can verify the information in the press. It helps to give him credibility.
Yeah.
He lies to him outright when he knows there's no way they can find out the answer.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
Names of pilots, number of missions, specifications about the equipment on board. Then he gives a part truth, a part lie, dances around the subject when he knows that they know something about the question they're asking, but not enough to contradict his answer, such as the altitude he was flying.
Yeah.
Dad always maintained that he was at the maximum altitude of 68,000 feet when he was shot down. And he did that to keep other pilots out of harm's way because they were flying higher.
Yeah.
And also to try to get a message back home to the CIA. Hey, guys, I'm not telling the full truth.
In our next episode, we spoke with Mirko Krum about the nuclear bunker he is preserving in West Germany and the network of other nuclear bunkers that were built in West Germany during the Cold War.
Some of the radiation levels were increasing. They could get the readings by telephone. There were also manned stations in bigger cities, which you could, I guess, call warning post. They were mainly included in already built civil defense bunkers, so they didn't get like extra bunkers or anything. Mm-hmm. But they could also measure radiation, measure other NBC threats, look at the skies and tell you if there's some enemy airplanes dropping bombs or whatever, because of course conventional warfare also had to be taken into account.
In episode 25 and 26, I spoke with Dr. Sergei Khrushchev, the son of former Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev. He recounted first-hand accounts of what life was like next to his father. Sergei was 20 when his father came to power, so had a real close knowledge of some of the decisions that were made during the Cuban Missile Crisis and also the Berlin Crisis. They are fascinating episodes and well worth a listen.
You see, this telephone is a Kremlin telephone. If they will call this and will tell you that they're calling from the Stalin's secretary say nothing, nothing. My father repeatedly told, after first shot, we will lose the control.
In episodes 27 and 28, we had another double bill where we spoke with US pilot Buzz Carpenter about his time flying the SR-71 Blackbird spy plane, but also about his time in Vietnam and his work with the Skunk Works.
The two-star head of Strategic Air Command's operations is there. Our deputy ambassador to the United Kingdom is there. The head of MI5 and MI6 is there. A number of British military individuals are there. So we go through the briefing. They had no idea if we had a problem where we should land. They said, that's up to you to try to figure out.
In September 2018, I visited the Soviet Threat Living History event at the Hack Green secret nuclear bunker in deepest Cheshire in the UK. I recorded this interview. He's with some friends here with a display around the Malayan emergency. So, Paul, what can you tell me about the Malayan emergency?
Well, in essence, it's where the Cold War starts and really turns aggressive. It starts with the murder of three rubber plantation owners in 1948 in Malaya. It slowly escalates to a point where Malaya tells the British government, says, we need help. And it's the British Army assisting the Malay police force to bring order and put down a communist insurgency in the jungle.
Episode 30 found me achieving an ambition of mine, which was to visit a UK nuclear monitoring post. I spent a fascinating morning with the former chief observer of the Rushton Spencer Royal Observer Corps nuclear monitoring post in Staffordshire. And it was great to get a first-hand account of what life was like in the Royal Observer Corps.
What do you think you would do if you'd actually had to do it for real? If it was the real thing, what would you have done?
On the face of it, you would hope you'd do what you were going to do, and that is man the post and do your job. Unfortunately, till that happened, you wouldn't really know. There were one or two that were on the post at the time, which I suspected may not have turned up. Others, Roger in particular, would definitely have been there.
In October, I spoke with Dr. Grace Huxford about her latest book about the Korean War experience in Britain.
When prisoners of war were captured, most of them were marched north into China. 22 American servicemen and one British serviceman are turned.
Episodes 32 and 33 saw us speaking with Eileen Ford Price. She was a British student in the GDR in the 1980s in Rostock. The second episode covered her return to the GDR, where she was a British teacher living and working in Berlin.
I was approached by the Stasi. I was visited by a woman, and each time, you know, I was more and more certain that, you know, she was making some kind of approach. And she did eventually start asking me for information about political views of other Western students.
Our next episode saw us return to Berlin, but this time the west side of the wall. We spoke with Sammy, who is a native West Berliner, described growing up in the city during the 1970s and 80s.
You did feel you were in the spy capital of the world, and you did feel you were very much at the centre of the Cold War.
Episode 35 is entitled The Man Who Owns a Soviet Submarine. Now, I was very surprised to discover there was a Foxtrot-class Soviet submarine moored in the middle of the River Medway in Kent. So I contacted its owner and was delighted to be able to arrange a personal tour.
I've been told by another Russian officer we were lucky enough, by the look of it, to be left a very early satellite navigation system, which he believes in 1994 was still pretty much top secret and shouldn't have been left on board.
Episode 36 saw another outside broadcast from Cold War Conversations, where we teamed up again with Dr. Richard Millington. We were at the Life in East Germany photography exhibition, which showed the works of Harold Hauswald, who documented everyday life in the GDR.
It was a society like any other society,
but also it was a society like no other society. It's this inherent contradiction in East Germany that is, I think, that a lot of people find fascinating.
The next episode saw us speaking with Antje Arnold, who is the author of The Girl Behind the Wall, describing an East German childhood.
I just really wanted to put like a lot of color on this quote-unquote black and white canvas that people always seem to have in their minds when they think about East Germany.
Episode 38 was the first of two episodes with Neil Gussmann, a US tank commander in West Germany during the Cold War. In this episode, he tells us about his initial training.
It was very much stressed that we were going to engage an enemy that was moving fast, and we were going to have to shoot accurately and keep shooting.
In episode 39, we spoke with Torsten Belger, who trained as an artillery officer in the East German Army. Now, when I started the podcast, I had no idea I would be speaking to an East German Army officer who lived less than 30 miles away from me.
And I applied to become an officer, professional officer in the Army, which meant 25 years minimum service. So when you signed up for 25 years. That was it. And there was no get. Once you're sworn in, then there was no getting out of it.
Episode 40 saw a joint operation between the GDR radio podcast and Cold War Conversations, where myself and Shane Whaley interviewed Peter Miller, an award-winning journalist who worked in East Berlin in the 1980s.
And we were decanted out into a police station, which is a police station yard with white tiles against the wall and concrete on the other side. And they started pushing us up to one side, and pushing lads with their arms and legs against the wall and running the truncheons up their inside legs.
This next episode saw us return to Neil Gussmann, who described his initial deployment in West Germany as a US tank commander.
And we loaded the ammo, which some of us had never done before. So we thought, wow, this is real. And then we drove up to the border, and when the fog burnt off, the Soviet tanks on the other side of the border were aimed at us.
Episode 42 was our last episode of 2018, where we spoke with Gillian Cox, who was a United States student in East Germany on the cusp of its destruction.
He has my passport in his hand. I am escorted to a red plastic bench. And I thought, I'm going to end up in the Stasi prison. And my crime is purple hair.
Well, that was 2018. If you like the podcast, please leave reviews on iTunes, as it really helps us get guests and increases our profile. If you are on Facebook, do join our discussion group. There's loads of Cold War information and further discussions with our guests and listeners like you. Just search Cold War Conversations. We're also on Twitter at Cold War Pod. Thank you very much for listening and supporting the podcast. It is really appreciated. Goodbye.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro, easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.
Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.